Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming to this press conference. I'm going to do it in two capacities, both as ambassador of Russia and maybe at some points as president of the Security Council. I'll be frank with you, I was provoked into this initiative by the press conference, which was conducted earlier today by my Ukrainian colleague, Ambassador Sergeyev. And usually I try to do my best not to criticize my colleagues directly, but unfortunately this time I was provoked into some criticism, which will follow. But, of course, the most important thing is not surprise at some of the things which were said by Ambassador Sergeyev, but also at the message which he was trying to deliver. He described some elements of what he said was going to be President Poroshenko's peace initiative, and while he was doing that, he repeatedly said that not only sort of the entire world has embraced this initiative, but also President Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov supported it. I double-checked, and I'm authorized to say that this is not true. It is premature to talk about our support for President Poroshenko's initiative, at least for the reason that we haven't seen it yet. This initiative was discussed, was outlined by Pyotr Poroshenko to President Putin in their phone conversation yesterday. And President Putin made some comments, particularly emphasizing the need to stop fire immediately and making some other comments with regard to this initiative. And in the discussion, in the phone conversation which Foreign Minister Lavrov had today with the new Foreign Minister of Ukraine, that initiative was not even sort of discussed in any detail. And I'd like to call your attention to the remarks which were made on this subject by Foreign Minister Lavrov at his press conference in Baku the day before yesterday, where he emphasized that whatever initiative comes out of Kyiv, it should not be an ultimatum and it should not resemble ethnic cleansing. Now, there's some personal comments on what Ambassador Sergeyev said. I mean, if he outlined what will be coming as President Poroshenko's initiative correctly, then I'm afraid that it may mean a lot of trouble, because things like a 10-kilometer buffer zone along the border, corridor through which people who want to leave eastern Ukraine would be able to go into Russia, disarmament in eastern Ukraine, all those things may well mean more bloodshed and even intensification of bloodshed rather than a peace initiative. But we'll see. We have not seen, as I say, the final product yet. When it comes out, then Moscow will form its attitude. But it is very premature to talk about Russian support. As a matter of fact, we are a little bit surprised that some of our foreign colleagues are rushing to support something which has not been presented yet. It is a serious subject which requires serious attention rather than sort of propaganda support of everything which might be coming out of Kyiv. Now, some other things which I have to respond to, which I heard Ambassador Sergeyev say today in this room. First, a startling comment from him that the Ukrainian forces had orders not to use heavy weapons. How come aviation jet fighters were used in the attack, missile attack on Lugansk administrative building a couple of weeks ago? A jet fighter fired missiles at the building. Heavy artillery have been shelling cities in eastern Ukraine. To claim that heavy weapons were not involved is really mind-boggling. An even more mind-boggling claim was that illegal groups are fighting civilians with Grad systems in eastern Ukraine. This narrative that somehow civilians die because the local armed group, local resistance groups, are firing at their own towns is really something which stretches, I think, even the Ukrainian propaganda. Now, he went on even further, and this, I think, may be the most troubling part of his press conference. When he described the situation when two Russian TV correspondents were captured by Ukrainian authorities, brought to Kyiv, beaten up, bruises all over the body, and then paraded before TV screens. He said that they apologized to the Ukrainian people. I mean, this kind of treatment is even unacceptable for prisoners of war, let alone journalists, when you hold people captive, beat them up, and then put them in front of television cameras. In fact, a part of the appearance I saw showed that they displayed a lot of courage when this young fella was asked how come bruises were on his face. He responded by a famous line from a very famous Soviet movie, "I fell when I came to, my hand was in plaster of Paris." Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, unfortunately for the Ukrainians, they did not see the contempt which he displayed to his captors in those words. And now, a final maybe thing, commenting specifically on what Ambassador Sergeyev, this is something he has been repeating again and again throughout various Security Council meetings, and also he repeated that today, that the Cossacks, some of whom may have found themselves in eastern Ukraine, somehow a part of the Russian armed force. This is simply not true. There is a law on the Cossacks, and there is nothing on that law which makes formations of the Cossacks, let alone individual Cossacks, members of the Russian armed force. So this, and there were some other things which I'm not even going into. The discourse which Ambassador Sergeyev went to on history after the coup in Kyiv in February, somehow my old colleague started developing a new line of history, starting with startling the world by claiming on the 4th of March that actually Ukrainian Nazi collaborators had not killed anybody, that all that was an invention of the Soviet Union. So in his history, theory of history, I'm not even going. Now, another thing which was addressed by Ambassador Sergeyev and which I'd like to inform you about is this request, which we, as Presidency of the Security Council, received from the delegation of Ukraine to conduct a Security Council meeting on the report of the Office of Commissioner for Human Rights in Ukraine, or Shimonovich, another report. And actually, he stated that that was kind of an unparalleled situation in history, that a meeting was not called. That, of course, is not true. The requests which come from various delegations are not acted on automatically by members of the Security Council. The Presidency and other members of the Security Council have to decide whether to how to respond to those requests, especially if it's not an emergency meeting request, which was not the case in this request by the Ukrainian delegation. But also, in our view, and that's why we are reluctant to call that meeting, and not that we are, don't want to discuss Ukraine. As you know, we have had 18, I think, meetings on Ukraine in various formats in the past 3 months, some of them convened on the initiative of the Russian Federation. The last one, last Monday, when we presented our draft resolution on Ukraine. But there were two sort of questions of principle. One, it is a report which was not commissioned by the Security Council, and it is a report on human rights. And we do have, and the group was invited by the Kyiv authorities. So if they want to discuss it, they can discuss it in Kyiv. Maybe they could go to Human Rights Council, but the Security Council is not about human rights. We even don't have experts on human rights here. We are discussing matters of international peace and security. So in my mind, as someone who has been trying to sort of hold the integrity of the Security Council, it's very dangerous to start discussing human rights reports, because we'll overshadow the Human Rights Council and maybe doom the Human Rights Council. In fact, already the prerogatives of the Security Council have been frayed, because we go into humanitarian matters, we go into this, we go into that. This is too much for the Security Council. This is one thing. The second thing is that it did seem to us that it was an attempt to take attention away from the actual drama of the situation in eastern Ukraine. You have fighting, you have a crisis, to which some members of the Security Council refused to respond, in my view, abrogating their responsibility as members of the Security Council, because if there is fighting, a crisis which has national dimension, then which is on the agenda of the Security Council, then the Security Council must try to take steps to stop this crisis, the fighting, as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, our Western colleagues, Western members of the Security Council, apparently decided to let it go, to let the military scenario play out. So in the context of this fighting and bloodshed in eastern Ukraine, to start discussing like human rights report, which is not a prerogative of the Security Council to do, in our view, is wrong. But anyway, today in consultations, we had a discussion with the members of the Security Council, so I wouldn't rule out that quite soon we'll have a meeting of the Security Council on Ukraine. But of course, it will not cover just this report, but the entire dramatic situation there. Unfortunately, I have no illusions about the ability of the Security Council to act, because the Russian delegation tried a number of times. We tried by trying to deliver a short statement calling on the end of violence in support of the Geneva communique of April 17 and in support of OEC roadmap. We tried in a more elaborate ways, introducing two draft resolutions of the Security Council, then merging them into one and having a discussion with our members of the Security Council about it. Unfortunately, our initial impression that maybe there is a way for us to agree on a resolution which would then have an impact on the situation in Ukraine, that assessment turned out to be inaccurate, that the next meeting showed that Western members of the Security Council were engaged in this old exercise of stonewalling. But anyway, it may well be that very shortly we will have that meeting, but certainly it will have to deal with the entire spectrum of the situation in Ukraine. Now, on this report itself, Ambassador Sergeyev did not hide his pleasure about the content of the report, and I understand why, because I must say very frankly, it completely repeats the narrative of the Kyiv authorities. And one marvels at the pensmanship of those who are writing this report in order to suit their own political inclinations. There is no hint of objectivity in that report. And to understand that, one only has to read the first page. And from the first page, I'll give you maybe two or three quotes. Paragraph 5. There has also been more regular and intense fighting as the government has been trying to restore peace and security over the eastern regions of Donetsk and Lugansk through security operations involving its armed forces. No reference to fighting, no reference to shelling, involving security operations, involving its armed forces. And they are trying to restore peace and security. I mean, you could apply this kind of description to any situation. You could say, they could say in their next report on Syria, that the government of Syria, Damascus, is trying to restore peace and security in their country. Isn't it true? They are trying to restore peace and security in their country. So this kind of politicized statement feeding directly into the narrative of Kyiv authorities, to me, is something not really worthy of High Commissioner for Human Rights and their office. Now, the people in eastern Ukraine, they are increasingly being caught in the crossfire between the Ukrainian military and the armed groups. Crossfire. So, I mean, it's just they are sitting somewhere in between in no man's land, and they're shelling from, like, fighting from both directions. This is not true. It is the Ukrainian military who have been shelling Slavyansk and other towns, Lugansk, involving also the use of air force. The next statement, in the same paragraph, the government must further use restraint. And then they could not even force themselves to write that. So they have it in the footnote, referring to Human Rights Watch, credible reports regarding Ukrainian forces' use of mortars and other weapons in and around populated areas, and the recent intensification of hostilities. So, you know, when you exercise, and you know, I could go on and on. If some of you are interested, I maybe could spend some more minutes about discussing this, helicopters using UN markings, which instead of looking at those helicopters, they try to justify the actions of Ukrainians, fantasizing about all those things being, you know, technically fabricated. Why didn't you just go and look at those helicopters? The Ukrainians were paid for repainting those helicopters and after they left peacekeeping operations in Africa. Where did this money go to? Were they actually repainted? It was not difficult to double-check on that. So instead of doing that, you know, those human rights people simply tried to find ways to justify the use of UN symbols on helicopters in military regions. So if we do have a discussion in the Security Council also involving this report, please rest assured that the Russian delegation is going to add some other things to those which I have mentioned to you in my opening remarks. So that's it, I think, for an opening statement. Please, ma'am. Oh, who is? Oh, yes, of course.
Thank you, Ambassador. On behalf of the UN Correspondents Association, thank you for this briefing. My question is, today the U.S. Added seven individuals to its sanctions list and said that Russia is moving troops back to the border of with Ukraine, and said that, you know, U.S. is always ready to impose more sanctions. And following Valerie Amos's closed briefing to the Council about the situation in Ukraine, she said there is no humanitarian crisis yet seen. So it appears that Russia's position on how dire the situation is not being agreed. It's not a view that's shared by anyone else. What's your response to that? And what do you say about the conflict or the situation regarding Ukraine, has it now reached another new phase where there are tensions mounting again about more sanctions against Russia?
Well, I don't want to. I mean, sanctions, it's their thing. If they want to go down that road, it's up to them. It's completely wrong. It's not serving any useful purpose. Now, our colleagues have their way. When they discuss humanitarian issues, it was embarrassing to me to be there in that room when they were kept asking, but it's not really a humanitarian catastrophe, is it? It's not really a humanitarian catastrophe. According to UN human rights person who did a briefing in Geneva, I think 2 days ago, they said 257 civilians killed as of June 18. Is it what? Catastrophe? It's not no problem? Even one colleague in the council, even though later on she refused that she said that, but I and some others heard it quite clearly, said, it's not such a big deal for the Security Council to deal with. Of course, more people have been killed in South Sudan. More. In South Sudan and Mali, probably more. In Central African Republic, more people have been killed. But does it mean that we need to disregard it as a problem? I think one good thing, useful thing, which we have done, we were able to attract the attention of international humanitarian agencies to the situation. And the International Red Cross is there. So it's a very dire situation. We have tens of thousands of people marching across the border. Then you have to confront this. And it's not a usual situation for any country, and especially, I'm sorry, for a European country, where you have artillery shelling civilian, shelling towns, water pumps, churches, hospitals, kindergartens, you know. It's all on our television. Of course, Ambassador Sergeyev claimed today when this child was killed that his parents were acting because they were paid by Russian television. You know, I don't even want to. It's sinking to a new low if this is going to be the only explanation of the situation one can produce. Ma'am, please.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. As I'm sure you know, the Secretary General gave a major speech this morning at the Asia Society on Syria. And he called for the Security Council to adopt an arms embargo on Syria. I wonder what your reaction is to that, given your government's close ties to the Syrian government. And in the speech, on the issue of accountability, the Secretary General also asked the countries that opposed referring Syria to the International Criminal Court, which were Russia and China, to come up with how other ways to ensure accountability for the perpetrators of crimes in Syria.
First of all, I haven't had the chance yet to read the statement by the Secretary General, so I'd rather not comment to what the Secretary General said, but your description of what he said. Well, first of all, on arms embargo, our position has been out there for a long time, and it's not changing. As I said in my previous appearance here, if they explain to us how the arms embargo will be enforced vis-a-vis various armed groups, then we could consider that. And we said that a long time ago, but we received no response to that. And, of course, we have the experience of Libya when there was an arms embargo and weapons were flowing freely to various opposition groups and still are floating all over Africa. So we do not want to go in that direction. Accountability. We made our position clear when we had a vote on this ICC referral resolution. Accountability, reconciliation, all those things must be dealt with by the Syrians as they try to settle this conflict. And we saw it as a move which was not really motivated by any considerations of justice or accountability. It was another attempt to sort of inject another element in this very difficult crisis situation to put more pressure on the Syrian government, because certainly you cannot realistically expect that the ICC will go after opposition leaders. And going after terrorist leaders, it does not make much sense, because they couldn't care less. Please. No. Oh, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Ambassador. My question about Iraq. Near to 2 weeks, the terrorist group occupied some cities north of Iraq, and the Security Council know any draft resolution, or you said last week we are going to consultation about this meeting. What's happening about Iraq?
Well, at this point, nothing much is happening in the Security Council, because we all agree that this is a very dangerous situation. We all agree that we must help the government. We all agree that there must be stronger effort at sort of national unity, and various political groups in Iraq must come together in order to defend the country against this onslaught of terrorists. We also, I think, agree that, or we have a common understanding that this is a sort of a major challenge coming from ISIS or ISIL, the way they call it sometimes differently, which is challenging not just Iraq, but Syria as well. And that we need to analyze very carefully. And I hope we'll be able to do that to start this analysis on Monday, when we're going to have our discussion of the Middle East settlement. In addition to Robert Seri, we also invited the Secretariat to give us a briefing on their understanding of the terrorist situation in the Middle East. Because what we've been doing, we've been discussing country to country, and the terrorists apparently, I mean, they don't recognize borders. They have their vision of geography. So now we have this ISIS fighting both in Syria and Iraq. What kind of conclusions we are going to draw from this? Actually, no, I saw a very interesting statement the other day. I think Mr. Jarba was speaking at the conference of probably Islamic conference somewhere. And he, and you look it up, it's not going to be an exact quote. He said it's... we cannot procrastinate any longer. There is this terrorist threat for both Iraq and Syria, putting them together. So in those terms, actually, I've been wondering, you know, our Western colleagues have criticized a lot the position of the Syrian government at the Geneva talks, because as they agreed, both the government and the opposition, that the first two items on the agenda of the discussions should be, first, fighting against terrorism, second, this transitional body. So the Syrian government was insisting that first they agree on something with regard to fighting terrorists. And the opposition was saying, no, we need also to agree on something. I think that from the point of view of the recent developments with ISIS, the position of the Syrian government does make a lot of sense. Because had they agreed on some practical steps to fight terrorists in Syria, well, first of all, that could have been a very important element of the situation and trying to suppress this terrorist threat in Syria. But then also this unity of purpose and action could have been created between the Syrian government and the opposition. So maybe that would have laid a path towards this transitional body, et cetera, et cetera. Because it's, of course, quite difficult to discuss like joint bodies theoretically. Just give us this portfolio or that portfolio. But if you have unity of purpose, which is fighting against ISIS could be, and I hope still is, then it could have made things different.
Yeah, Mr. President.
I'm sorry, I'll come to you later. Please, you.
Me? Okay, just really quickly on your Ukraine draft. You said earlier this week that it was on the level of DPRs, and I was wondering if it moved to ambassador level yet, the discussion on it.
Well, unfortunately, after the last discussion on the level of DPRs, we came to the conclusion that our Western colleagues were stonewalling, that they were not interested in the draft. In our revised draft, we accommodated a lot of their concerns and proposals, including a reference to sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. But, you know, they came back, coming back with killer amendments, and we came to the conclusion that there is no prospect for that draft to develop.
Yeah, Mr. President, the Palestinian delegate here sent a letter to the Security Council and to the Secretary General regarding the situation in the occupied territories. Of course, Israel is arresting people wantonly and killing people wantonly as well, under the pretext there has been abduction of three Israelis. This has not been verified in any way, and there are skepticism even in the Israeli media that this action has happened. What's the position of the Security Council with this regard?
We are going to discuss this on Monday, I'm sure. We're going to have a special meeting on Monday. Matthew, please.
Sure. Thanks a lot. On behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, thanks for the briefing. I asked Ambassador Sergeyev about the journalists that were killed, not just the ones that were beaten, and he seemed to say that they should have had their helmets on, that they hadn't registered. I just wanted to know, he also said that at the stakeout. What you think after the press statement of that, and also just now the spokesman for the Secretary General said that the Secretary General, while he was giving the speech, that they welcome the Poroshenko plan and that they find it encouraging. These were two words used. What do you think of that?
I'll have to look at Secretary General's comments. I think any senior official would want to look at the plan before welcoming it. You know, this is my response. But about the journalists, again, very unpleasant part of what Ambassador Sergeyev has been saying. He said twice already at that media stakeout and now today. And he seems to go to considerable details in his description of what actually could have happened. And sometimes some details are changed, but he is talking as if he or Ukrainian authorities were there. In fact, to me, this is another indication of the claim which is made in our media that those journalists had been followed and targeted for a number of days before they were actually targeted and killed by that mortar fire. Please, over there. Yes, you, please. Yes.
Okay.
I'll go to you afterward.
Syrian Ambassador Bashar Jafari, when he was speaking on Wednesday evening, he suggested that there was a pattern of mistreatment of the Syrian mission by UN bodies, by his webcast being cut off and things to that effect. Do you have any similar observations? And if that's the case, what can be done about it?
No, I mean, if the webcast was cut, which was broke off technically, of course, that should not happen. I hope the technology works well. Please, sir.
Thank you, Ambassador. Has the Security Council discussed or plans to discuss the new crisis brewing in Afghanistan following the boycott announced by a presidential candidate of the election process? And as a Russian ambassador, do you have any comments on that?
Well, we are going to have a big discussion on Afghanistan on Thursday, I think, next Thursday. So we'll cover all those subjects, I'm sure.
Ambassador, thanks for your remarks concerning Ambassador Sergeyev's statements today. We're also hearing reports from other sources that there is Russian military involvement in eastern Ukraine. Can you unequivocally explain what, if anything, is there? There are reports today that there are heavy armored personnel carriers or tanks crossing the border. What is this all about?
There are various reports. Our officials repeatedly said that there is no Russian military presence on the ground. The statement today, there was a statement that allegedly there was a new buildup. The statement which came back from our officials was that the border guards were sort of beefed up because of the complaints, of including complaints from Kiev, that the border was not protected well. But the situation, it's a pretty volatile situation.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I have two questions, one in Ukraine, one in Syria. In Ukraine, you and the Council are prepared to look into humanitarian issues when they threaten peace and security in the world. Don't you agree that human rights violations do some, in the case of Ukraine, threaten peace and security?
Not the way it's described in the report. The report is glossing over and ignoring the real tragedy which is happening in eastern Ukraine. And they go sometimes in rather bizarre ways into all sorts of accusations about various things. One of my other personal bests, actually, from this report is that when it comes to the Ukrainians cutting off water supply to Ukraine, they say they do not have any presence in Crimea, from Crimea, Ukrainians to Crimea. They say they don't have any access to Crimea, no presence in Crimea, so they cannot judge the impact. But the other things they can judge on, you know. They can judge on all the other things. That's basically saying that everything has become worse. So it's really such a work of pensmanship that one can only marvel, as I said, at their ability to twist and turn in order to avoid the truth.
And in Syria, the humanitarian resolution, I understand that Russia will have no problem with the four crossing and bringing aid to the people who need it and in dire need for it. But maybe the monitoring of these borders is the problem. I'm just guessing.
You know,
would a monitoring, international monitoring mechanism under the supervision of the United Nations Secretary General, would that be a problem? Or what would you like to see as Russia?
Well, what we would like to see, we have developed already. And here I have to speak, of course, in my national capacity and very carefully, because I do cope. Things will happen very quickly, and this resolution will be adopted very quickly. The Troika, Luxembourg, Australia, and Jordan produced a draft which we found to be something which is going to mean only trouble, but not humanitarian, helping the humanitarian situation, Chapter 7, the whole thing. But in the course of our lengthy and very detailed discussions, we produced a formula.
What is it?
I'd rather not discuss it because it has not been finally approved, which produced a formula which would allow humanitarian supplies to go through crossing points, additional crossing points on the border between Syria, Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon, and which will simplify the humanitarian procedures when the goods are actually on the territory of Syria. So this formula is out there for our Western colleagues to accept. And we negotiated for a very long time and very thoroughly. Then when the final thing was on the table, they started reflecting on what it actually means. Frankly, my suspicion is that their main interest very often is not really humanitarian issues. It's to produce some kind of a political big bang. When the political big bang is not there, when in fact we focus on the humanitarian situation, then quite often they lose interest in the entire exercise. So we'll see what comes out of this discussion on the resolution.
On the same subject, do you think that they want Chapter 7 and insist on that?
Well, if they insist, it's not going to happen, especially now that we have produced a way in which it can be done amicably. And incidentally, for example, we had a discussion with the Iraqis, and because one of the crossing points would be on their territory, they said, we don't want to mess up with Chapter 7. I mean, some neighbors of Iraq who would also be involved in this arrangement. They don't want that to happen. So it's just not...
But just to follow up, is this
the Lebanese, do they accept that?
The Lebanese are not involved. Now we are talking about crossing points with three countries. Lebanon is not involved.
Is this mechanism that you suggested under the control of the Syrian, solely the Syrian government?
No, no, it's not. It's an innovative formula, an elegant, innovative formula. I'll let you know. I'll let you know with pleasure if the resolution is adopted, with sadness if it's not adopted. But it's
any more meetings planned on this?
No, they are reflecting. We are sitting there since Tuesday, I think, and they are reflecting now. So it's
a joint mechanism.
It's a good mechanism, yes. Last question. Matthew, please.
Sure. I want to go back to the Simonovic report. We were told in this room a couple of times that there would be an extensive treatment of the bombing of the Luhansk administrative building. And when I got the report, it seems like there's only one paragraph. And I asked Simonovic, and he said that they had no armaments experts on the team. Is that, I mean, who's paying for the team? And is that, what's your understanding
about
that?
Well, I don't know. The paying procedures, if the United Nations is paying, I think they are wasting a lot of time. And, it's ridiculous. They showed, actually, from this attack, which they used it's not like small missiles. I don't know how they projectiles. One of them is stuck on the ground near the building, and they don't have experts, you know. Please.
Two last questions. On Ukraine, just to clarify, Western members of the Council say that they would be keen to discuss the humanitarian resolution on Ukraine if Russia would agree to making a reference to the UNGA resolution that did not recognize Crimea as part of Russian Russia, and that thereby guaranteeing ensuring the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
Yeah, actually,
are you not willing to do that? Are you willing to do that?
No, actually, this was a part of an understanding which we had with some of members of the Council. We discussed it with that there will be a reference of sovereign territorial integrity, but no reference to the General Assembly resolution.
And why not?
Because. And because it has clear implications on the Crimea. And we are not going to have there anything which would be putting in question the fact that Crimea has been reunited with the Russian Federation.
And one last thing on Iraq. Looking at what happened at the unrest, Russia's position on how to proceed forward or revive the Geneva process is that the opposition needs to sit with the Assad government and discuss ways to address terrorism. Is that the only way, or are you looking for new ways?
First of all, it's not Iraq, it's Syria you're talking about, aren't you? You said Iraq.
But looking at how ISIL and ISIS has spilled over.
Yeah, I thinking about it, I came to the conclusion that actually Syrian government did have a very strong point when they insisted that first they must agree on how to deal with the terrorist threats. Seems to be the main challenge in the region, and the challenge is not only in Iraq and in Syria. And had they agreed to do something jointly about it, that would have been a great way to start for them working together and maybe to produce that joint transitional body which they are supposed to produce under the Geneva Accords. You understand, it's very difficult to talk about those things theoretically. Here comes the Syrian government to the table, and here comes somebody who claims he is representing the opposition and tells them, please give us half of your power, you know, because it's said in the Geneva communique. You need to discuss it pragmatically and practically, what actually you will be doing to do together, and to start fighting terrorism together, which is also actually an appeal which was contained on the initiative of the British Prime Minister in the G8 communique in Lucerne, that they should fight terrorism together. So I think that was an opportunity which was lost. But I'm not suggesting that this is something which should be done now. I'm not suggesting to revisit this issue. Because now I think we are all thinking that the political process needs to restart. Unfortunately, there has been a delay of appointment of Mr. Brahimi's successor. We hope there will be successor and a good successor before too long. And then we all will need to analyze the situation and see how we can go about it. As far as we are concerned, we believe that the Geneva communique is still valid and that the Geneva conference, it has not been declared over. So this mechanism is still there. And we must keep it in mind as we contemplate our next steps. Thank you very much.